Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston, say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Welcome to the Space Junk Podcast. My name is Annie Hanmer, and I'm your host. And this week, I spoke to David Knopf, who recently spent 537 days in Antarctica as the leader at Davis Station. David and his team didn't know when they left Australia in late 2019 that the COVID-19 pandemic would change the world and leave them isolated longer than they'd ever expected, while forcing them to endure an extended stay without resupply and alone. Prior to his posting in Antarctica, David worked with the Australian Defence Force and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, focused on counter-terrorism in the Middle East. He credits his experience of working in a dynamic and hostile environment as shaping his approach to leading teams in unpredictable circumstances and under constant change. Antarctica is a very useful analogue when we think about what it might be like to have lunar bases and long-term space missions. And it turns out that David is a massive space nerd. And when I reached out to him to come on the podcast and talk about his experiences, he very kindly agreed to do so. Unfortunately, due to lockdowns, we had to have our conversation over Zoom rather than over a beer in Melbourne, which I think both of us would have vastly preferred, but it turned out to be a fascinating and uplifting conversation that bridged polar medicine, penguins, homebrew, dating in Antarctica, The Bachelor, and so much more. So please, as always, forgive the slightly less than optimal audio quality, and with that, let's get into the podcast. G'day, Space Junkies. Welcome back to the Space Junk Podcast. Today, I'm sitting on my windowsill with a cup of tea, and I am chatting via Zoom to David Knopf, who's down in Melbourne, I believe. David, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thriving. Absolutely thriving. It is week six of lockdown in Sydney, and I've reached the point where I've forgotten what it was like before lockdown, and so I'm actually quite happy, which is a really nice place to be. But I believe you're also in some sort of quarantine situation in Melbourne, is that right?
That's right. So I'm on day 13 out of a 14-day quarantine, which is exciting because I get to go out and go for a test after this. So that would be my first day out since my day 2 test. But that was my penance for a 7-day trip to Thredbo. As the lockdown was emerging, and I was meeting a bunch of mates from Canberra. So rolled the dice, went to Thredbo, and then now it's 14 days home jail after that trip. So anyway, the price you pay.
That is the price you pay, I guess. But I'm glad that you're keeping Melbourne safe, and thank you for doing the right thing and all of those good things. And yeah, in Sydney, I understand the boredom of being locked down and the excitement of going for a test. It's a couple of weeks ago, I was I woke up and I was like, ooh, do I maybe have a slightly scratchy throat? And so I went and got a test because I just needed something to do. And it was great. It was really nice. I had some human interaction and I obviously came back negative, but it was a fun experience nonetheless. So yeah. David, I should reveal to our listeners who you are and why you're here on the podcast. They're a trusting bunch and they go with me on a lot of things, but it probably is the moment. Would you like to introduce yourself? You've just taken a sip of tea, sorry. Would you like to introduce yourself and
yeah, explain who you are and what you've just spent the last year-ish, more, almost 2 years doing.
Sure. So I'm not an astronaut, but David Knopf, I spent the last year and a half down at Davis Station, Antarctica, as a station leader there. And we'd left Australia back in October 2019 before COVID and before the world changed. And then we watched the world grapple with the pandemic from the safe and isolated location of Antarctica. But then it impacted us quite severely, and we couldn't get home as planned due to shipping and aviation logistical problems thanks to COVID. And we ended up coming home in April 2021, which took the overall time away from Australia to about 537 days. So it was, to make it relevant for space, it's more or less a return trip to Mars.
Oh.
If you were on Mars for about a day and then you turned around and came home, which of course you probably wouldn't do. But so that's my story. And I learned a lot of things about ourselves and isolation and community and everything along the way.
Yeah, well, I'm keen to get into that. I do think it's quite amusing that you're part of the international mail delays that occurred because of logistics. You had to hang out there a bit longer waiting to be loaded onto planes. But let's get on to that. Let's start with, how did you come to become a station leader in Antarctica? Because it has to be one of the hardest jobs to land. And I've read your little bio, your CV, and I must say it is just one of the most interesting bios I've read, and I run this podcast. So I would love for you to just explain a bit about sort of where you started, what your career's done, and then how you ended up in Antarctica.
No worries. Well, funnily enough, one of the team actually called me out on this once, is that station leader is one of the few jobs on station that actually have zero qualification requirements other than a, you know, driver's license. Whereas everything else on station, you need to be a doctor or a qualified chef or a mechanic or a scientist or anything like that. So it's one of the few jobs that is a generalist thing. And there's no stereotype for station leaders, but I had a background in the ADF. I was an army officer for a couple of years and then transferred from that to foreign affairs and trade. And I did a range of postings around the world and mainly around the war on terrorism. So I was posted to Pakistan and then Iraq, and I spent some time in Turkey and traveled around Southeast Asia and Europe and everything with work. So I had a range of government experience there, but then also had a huge amount of travel experience in and around that. So I'd been to Antarctica before on a private mountaineering trip with a bunch of mates. We chartered a yacht out of Ushuaia and sailed to the Antarctic Peninsula for a month and hiked up mountains and then, you know, snowboarded and splitboarded up and down and had a ball. But that made me fall in love with Antarctica as a location. And it was then, my boss in Pakistan, who was the High Commissioner to Pakistan, Peter Haywood, shout out to him if he listens to your podcast. But
Hi, Peter.
He and I got chatting about it, and he'd spent some time with the Antarctic Division, and it was from Tasmania. And then I sort of looked at the jobs, and it took a while to line up more or less like the taking a year off your life and where it fits with your career stream. So when I was over in Iraq and I'd spent a year and a bit over there back and forth, and I was getting pretty tired of that and decided that, all right, now's the time to focus on trying to get a job down in Antarctica as a station leader and go through the hoops to, you know, pass the selection process for that, which was quite rigorous and one of the most interesting selection processes I'd seen of any of my previous jobs as well. So that was really cool to get through that process and then get offered a job down there to run the station was phenomenal. And then events played out that it was quite an interesting year as well. So got a much longer and much more interesting experience than I'd ever signed up for.
So just in terms of becoming station leader, obviously that's a huge change of pace to go from terrorism work in the Middle East to say, okay, I'm going to go and hang out with a bunch of people in Antarctica. Were you, like, when you were going through the process of applying for station leader, was your previous experience something that they thought would be an asset, or were they looking more for your personal qualities? What was that experience like in terms of the interviews? I'm sure it's all very like top secret and you can't disclose how you get the job, but I'd be really interested to know how you go about selecting a person who is capable of leading a group in difficult circumstances, knowing that Antarctica's got a bit of a history of people going a little bit, you know, not necessarily sticking the course in the way that they should over winter and so on.
No, and I don't think it is overly top secret how they select their people, because the criteria and the requirements, which is people who can get along with everyone, are adaptable, are resilient, and you know, a lot of buzzwords, you can't fake them. And the Antarctic Division's been selecting people to go south for a number of years, and they do a pretty good job of filtering you out through their selection process. So if you could fake it for a one-hour interview, or you could put up with people you don't like for a short amount of time, their selection process would do a pretty good job of weeding it out to be like, yeah, you can't fake that. You're either someone that gets along with others easily or can adapt and think, not necessarily outside the box, but you're aware of, okay, it's not just about the one job I've got. It's about community, and it's about helping the team and changing your profile of your job, or if it's required. So there's a lot of those factors that come into it. My previous work, funnily enough, if you look at an Antarctic station, which is a lot like a small town, you've got to have, you know, multiple generators and then accommodation buildings and shower facilities and then your storerooms and science and all these things. There was a lot of similarities to some of the forward operating bases you'd see in war zones. The only difference in sometimes was the color. So a lot of it was still shipping containers and everything, which in the war zones are all painted, you know, desert colors. And then in Antarctica, they're bright colors. So if you get lost in a blizzard, you'll be able to see the green building or the red shed or anything like that. So there was some eerily familiar elements to it, but a very different vibe and attitude. It's much, much more collegiate and, you know, happier on an Antarctic station at times than it can be in the war zones. But the community events side of things as well was something that, one of my favorite memories from Iraq was, used to do yoga sessions once a week or something. But getting like an indirect fire alarm in the middle of yoga where you all run out and you have to put your body armor on and everything and sit in the bunker for a bit to wait for the alarms to go off. And then you go back into yoga, back to whale noises and Zen. It was kind of those experiences and having that background helped in Antarctica as well, because it's very similar. You get so focused and so stressed about your work half the time, but you need to make sure that, okay, I can switch off and go and do yoga or play pool or darts or whatever it is that you do to kind of relax and you know, be yourself for a bit.
The moment when you were down in Antarctica, you've been leading this group through a difficult winter, and then you're told, actually, you're going to have to stay for another 4 months. What was that moment like personally and for the group in Antarctica?
I remember that day quite vividly, and as the station leader I was privy to the notion that was coming. And I think a lot of expeditioners saw the writing on the wall from about April or so, when the real lockdowns and the world was changing. You realize like, oh, I don't think they're going to be able to get us in November. But it wasn't until June that we were told formally, like, oh, actually, right, you're not coming home in November. And so we should have only been 100 or so days away from the first flights coming in to start the summer season. They said, yeah, there's no flights. And we're in between icebreakers. So we just retired one icebreaker and the new one was delayed with being built. So we won't be able to get you till early 2021. And as a leader, it changed for me in that up until that point, I was leading a group of people that kind of knew what they signed up for. And then it changed to, I was now going to be leading a group of people who didn't really sign up for that challenge. In the broader sense, everyone that goes to Antarctica, you know that these sort of things can happen, but it was markedly different from that point on of, okay, I'm here longer than I'm supposed to be. And there were a few issues along the way of people going, well, I'm not even supposed to be here. And you're like, well, yeah, but you are here. So I need you to still, you know, do your job and act professionally. And I had up and down moments as well. So that changed for me personally. For the group, it was tough. I mean, that was longer away. It meant for a lot of us, second birthdays, a second Christmas, a second New Year's, people's family and friends died back home along the way, which happens every year kind of anyway, but more of that starts to happen. And there was so much uncertainty back home that was tough to kind of, the first thing when the world started changing with COVID, the first thing you want to do was kind of get home and see everyone and go, I'm here for you, I can look after you. And much tougher for those with kids and families and stuff back home. But for us to still be stuck there and just have to watch it even longer, as you knew that it was having an impact on people's mental health and well-being back home, and you just can't do anything about it. You're like, well, we're here. And in a lot of ways, we were having quite a lot of fun. We had a lot of freedom. We were able to do lots of stuff down there. And at times, compared to Melbourne or other places around the world in hard lockdowns, we had it much better, but you don't want to rub it in too much.
Yeah. Did you have any concerns about getting COVID on the base? Like, especially, you know, if you've got people coming in using the airstrip or something from other countries, they might be doing something different. Like, did you have to have protocols in place or wear masks or socially distance?
We did. So funnily enough, anything that came via ship, it's about a 2-week voyage from Hobart. So that sort of covered the quarantine there. So when the ship did eventually come, we had one day where we ran masks and stuff, but it wasn't too bad. We had to do a medical evacuation just before Christmas 2020 using a Chinese helicopter that met an American plane that came across from McMurdo. And largely the polymedicine unit and everyone had done a lot of research and work on counting who'd been in and out and off the continent. And it's just one of those factors that massive consequence if you get it wrong, but very low risk of like, okay, the chances of COVID actually getting to all these other stations with everyone doing, because the risk I think there was from the Americans who had new people in since COVID started through the kind of New Zealand to McMurdo link, but they'd all done like 2 weeks or a month or something in New Zealand in quarantine before they flew to McMurdo. So you start to go like, oh, very low risk, but the consequences are massive. You've got one doctor. We use lay surgical assistants on stations. There's no qualified nurses or anything. It's just a few expeditioners get trained up in Hobart beforehand. So that's the risk of it. The doctor could manage one critical patient, not two, not three, certainly not four. And so you start to go, like, all right, we can't risk it. But it was a concern. There was one of the Chilean bases, I think, that had COVID, but over on the Antarctic Peninsula, it's much closer to South America and much easier for them to handle. And the problem at Davis and a lot of the other Antarctic stations is you're so far away from help and there's no cavalry, there's no additional facilities or doctors you can surge and help deal with a COVID outbreak or any outbreak on station.
What was it like being in Antarctica and seeing the news and seeing this thing, you know, rocking its way around the world?
So the main thing was it was hard to get an understanding of what it was actually like back home. And we had on the stations was 24 of us down there for the winter. And and from all over Australia and New Zealand, it was about 5 Kiwis out of the 24 and people lived from far reaches of Western Australia to the cities and Northern Queensland and all over. So it was really different for us to, really difficult for us to understand which place to believe, because some families and friends and stuff back in, say, Western Australia, they're like, well, it's really, you check in occasionally and it's not really had much of an impact. Whereas for myself from Melbourne and others, it was huge. And then I had, benefit of my previous career, I got friends all around the world and chatting to a friend over in Sweden and different, and hearing all these different stories, it was so hard to get an understanding of like, well, which one do we believe? And what is it actually like to go down to the shops or see the streets or the cities? And that was surprising. When I got home, I was expecting to go to the shops and see, you know, full lease signs everywhere and boarded up things and people out of work. And there's none of it. In a lot of ways, there was a few places that went broke, but nothing out of the ordinary of what seems to change every year anyway. So that was the biggest challenge, was understanding what actually changed and what is life like back home now.
Was there anything that did change that you were surprised about or that you noticed?
Yeah, two or three things I really noticed when I got back. Number one is the amount of litter around Australia, and that really disappointed me. I know that was bad before I left, but just sort of noticing a lot more litter around and masks, and that we sort of, I did joke to a friend that, like, oh wow, with COVID, we solved terrorism, so that was good. No one talks about that anymore, so that's a win. But we gave up on the environment. There's just rubbish everywhere, and it would appear they're like, oh yeah, no, we just stopped caring about that. You just throw your masks wherever and everything's disposable, and like Uber Eats and takeaway containers, like, yeah, stuff it, whatever, get rid of keep cups, like, don't bother with them anymore. And they all had good reasons why we did it, but I think that's been a big loss, and that was a change. And then the sheer amount of time you're forced to spend on your phone now, of just you go out to, when you are allowed out, you go out and then it's like, oh no, don't go and talk to humans at the bar, sit at your table, use the QR code, order your own drinks individually with your phone. So you go out to see your friends to not look at a screen, and then you're out and they're like, look at a screen, you know, use your screen the whole time. So that changed remarkably. And look, they're probably not earth-shattering revelations to anyone, but that shocked me on return of those sort of those key things.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. I've noticed that I now find it's often better, like socially, to have a Zoom call with someone than it is even in Sydney if you're allowed to go for a walk with someone who's in your area or whatever. Like going for a walk with someone and keeping 1.5 meters distance, yeah, and being masked and trying to communicate is like the worst experience in the world. So it's interesting the way that we've changed. And I know that, yeah, that environmental point is one that a lot of people are raising, that we've kind of sacrificed that because we had to, but now we're thinking about what are the long-term consequences? How do we roll this thing back? How do we get back on track? Okay, let's go back, dive back into Antarctica. I want to talk about how do you entertain yourself through a long winter? What was it like being part of, you said 24, was it? People over months of darkness in a confined space where if you go outside, it might kill you. What are you doing? How are you keeping that harmonious? How do you resolve conflict? What's that situation like?
Yeah, and these are, of course, all the relevant things to how do you run a space station or a colony and everything as well.
Which, 100%. Yeah, no, my listeners have kind of got the gist by now that we don't necessarily stay on track, but it's all relevant. This is the problem. Okay, so because I do sociology of science and as my academic path, it means I spend a lot of time looking at analogs and looking at disconnected things, and then at the very end being like, oh, and it all ties in. So yes, I should point out, yes, this is all very relevant for people who are thinking about space missions and bases. At the moment, there's a lot of talk about like putting a base on the moon and maybe doing several, probably in a model similar to Antarctica, because that's something that we know and love. Also, on the international legal perspective, the international law regimes that govern Antarctica and activities on celestial bodies have a lot of similarities and ways that we can draw on each one for the other. And generally there's a lot of relevance there from a lot of perspectives in terms of planning that kind of activity. So yes, there we go. There's the intro I should have given.
Perfect. No, that's good. And look, so the main thing is with that is to keep yourselves entertained and everything, is to take the most of the opportunities that you've got. I mean, if you certainly in Antarctica, you can get out and about and enjoy the wilderness and the wildlife. Around Davis, we had, you know, hundreds of square kilometers of rocky outcrop and sea ice and small little mountain-ish kind of hills that we could go and climb around and enjoy. But it wasn't always blue sky, perfect weather to go and do that. And I found that expeditioners who pushed for those opportunities, even when it wasn't perfect or had to move things around to make it work, got out and had a better and richer experience rather than, I could just stay in today. I can stay in my comfort zone than get out there and push it. So there's that, which is going out the front door is probably the best reset off an Antarctic station you'll ever get to get off station. There's a great amount of huts and refuges around the Aussie stations that you can go and see, which are, I don't think many other programs really have in the same way that we do. So you can go and get a bunch of mates together, load up the vehicles, head out, and you know, spend the night at a hut in the middle of nowhere just with your friends. You cook up a steak dinner, the chef will put a cheese plate together, and you have a great night and you feel like you've been away. And then you set up the best thing as well down there, certainly in the winter, looking at the Southern Lights, the Aurora Australis. So you go out and you set up all your time-lapse cameras and your GoPros and power packs with, like, you know, the amount of heating required to try and keep them from auto shut off and all that. So that it's just fascinating, and looking at the Southern Lights is breathtaking. So you do that, but when you're stuck inside, which does happen, you know, quite a bit, using what you've got around you in your community was really important for us. And we did it was an intangible kind of win, but we ran a lot of programs to run like community college and learning off each other from different skill sets and different backgrounds, and then talks and seminars on different things. So if someone had a topic to talk about, that was great, and they'd get up and they'd give a presentation. It gave them something else to do for the week to prepare it and put their photos together and, you know, come up with a slideshow. And if we ran out of topics, we'd just put on a TED talk or a strange kind of movie and everything as well. And then, you know, really relevant to your team as well, we had a bit of a space club where we'd get up for the launches, which were
great.
3 a.m. or whatever, and it sort of brought it home a bit as well, because when Perseverance launched, And we got to see it launch, and then of course we also got to see it land. But so you're like, wow, that's how long we were away. It went all the way to Mars and everything. But that sort of stuff just broke up your routine. And as important as routine is in isolation, things that are outside of the routine and can stimulate you a bit more are really important too. And funnily enough, chatting to most of the expeditioners, they said before we even went down that they had at one point in their life kind of considered being astronauts, but like, well, but in Australia, it's, you know, it's really hard, or you just know that you're not going to be an astrophysicist or a test pilot that can go and fly a spaceship. So you go, all right, well, what's the next best thing? You're like, all right, well, I'll just go and become this, and I'll get myself down to Antarctica. And there's some broader similarities that I think attract similar people.
Definitely. The analog system, like to look at it from the outside, obviously works, right? If you're trying to do analysis and figure things out and compare and contrast these things, that works. But also from a human perspective, the sort of person who's going to be enthused about going and hanging out on an Antarctic base over winter is probably the sort of person who would be okay with going and hanging out on the moon or Mars. And that's not to be sneezed at, because not everyone, and especially we've found this through lockdowns, not everyone can cope with that kind of isolation and knowledge that you're stuck. It's the knowing that you haven't got another option than being where you are for that time. I think that really rocks a lot of people. And maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe people who have that military background as well are more able to cope with it. But I know that when I've looked in the past at applying to go and work in Antarctica, which I've done on numerous occasions, and I'm always like, oh, I am underqualified for all of these positions. And there's like one job where, like, I think it was like the person who washes dishes or something, where I was like, maybe I could be that person. But they're very clear. They're like, no, you have to be someone who actually has a proven track record of being able to do this thing day after day and not hate it. Yeah, there are some similarities there. And I know that there are people who spend their lives doing, like, experimenting on and studying people like yourself. Mm. Were you part of any studies while you were there?
We weren't. So the Antarctic program has in the past been parts of studies. And I've always said as well, so since I got back, I've been doing a few bit of public speaking and everything, which is quite hard as well in lockdown, but the online talks and webinars to different groups, from schools to corporate entities and that. And I've felt that at some point it will be fascinating to sit down with a bunch of clinical psychologists or someone like that would just love to hear some of the social issues that happened. And obviously I can't go into all the details of some of that stuff, but that side of it would be fascinating. And myself and a number of experts, and all of us really, you'd sit there watching different things unfold around you and different dynamics and different tables of, like, the, you know, who's on this table, and then we'd break that up. And so funny you say kitchen duty. So the Australian stations, that's just done by the community. So every 23 days or so you had to be kitchen assistant, and then you'd redo the tables and see what that changed with the dynamic, and then you try and ruffle feathers and sit in someone's chair, and there was all those little things that just went on. And a lot of it, look, they never really caused any major problems, but they were always just sort of niggling things away in the background that over time do get to you. And it's funny you say with selection of people, that you'd almost, a lot of the people down there are quite overqualified for their core job, and that comes down to, it's not just good enough to have the bare minimum qualification for, say, a sparky or a mechanic or something, but although an engineer, it's like, all right, actually, yes, you could get by with that base level qualification, but there's so many complexities and so much legacy equipment and other things down there. You go, oh, we do need someone that's quite overqualified. So you core job can get pretty boring pretty quick. So then it comes down to those other elements of, like, all right, are they someone that has a sense of community and an interest in all these other things outside of that? And we'd often talk about, like, oh, well, if you had to pick between two expeditioners that were sort of, one was overqualified but a bit of a tool versus someone who's underqualified but like a really nice person, you take the nice person any day of the week, because after a year, that's what's going to cause problems. So that's a fascinating element of it. And I think looking at the space missions, that, you know, at the moment, and for the history of space, it has been, it's always been like really high performing NASA astronauts and all that. And, you know, they'll like, you know, some of the guys up there, you know, they're like, they've been a Navy SEAL and a doctor and an engineer and your stuff. You're like, all right, well, it's pretty unrealistic for the average person. But at a point in the next few years, as they start sending missions to moon bases and others, it'll dilute a bit and you will need people that have more average skills, that kind of like the Armageddon scenario of like, well, actually it's easier to train miners to be astronauts than astronauts to be miners. So not saying that movie's one to aspire to look at how the future of space exploration work, but it'll happen.
It's pretty great. It's a good movie. Like,
yeah. I heard a rumor that NASA make aspiring astronauts watch it and have to pick up the like 195 errors within it or that something like that, which makes sense. But anyway.
Fair enough. So what sort of skills did you have on the base? And I know you can't go into details, but I'd love to hear the sorts of conflicts that arose, whether it was, you know, people sitting in other people's chairs or whatever else. I've heard great tales in my own research about like Soviet expeditions coming to blows over chess games and all sorts of things like that. So I understand it can be a fairly, what they call on Married at First Sight, a pressure cooker situation.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, I mean, like, I guess I'm asking you to reflect on both of those things there. What are the kind of beautiful moments of, I don't know, people getting together and having a jam or something? And then what are the moments where you have people having a conflict over something where you're like, really? Like, why are you having this conflict?
Yeah, well, I mean, some my two best moments or three best moments, there was, we ran two art shows. So there was an amazing amount of depth in the skill sets of the expedition crew that, you know, they might have been down there in one role, but they were secretly like an amazing artist. And that's from musical side of things. We had some band nights and live music at different occasions to creative art, whereas, you know, there's a lot of links between Tasmania and the Antarctic program and stuff. So we kind of created a Mona-esque style thing. And that was great to sort of serve, you know, hors d'oeuvres and champagne and open an art show and have the violin and piano and all that sort of stuff. And the stuff that people made was so creative. And it even had the summer art show, even had like a kind of a video piece that someone had been involved in producing, this theater piece, and they'd put that on the big screen. And it had all these different vibes. So those memories were phenomenal because they were so far away from our other personalities and our core role. And that was a hoot. And the other one we had was when we'd have the social committee meetings, which didn't always work, but, you know, you'd have them. And it was getting towards Cinco de Mayo and then May the 4th be with you, the Star Wars things. We're like, let's put them together. So we ran an event called Cinco de Mayo, the 4th be with you, which was a Star Wars themed Mexican Cinco de Mayo party, and just seeing people turn up as like Mexican Han Solo, and we had a Death Star pinata, and it was so stupid but so amazing and such a great memory those moments I felt are the ones that you remember. But at the other end of that spectrum, I had to mediate a few disputes over some pretty petty things that you look back and you go, geez, that's not your finest moment. And you kind of go, how did that get to the station leader's office that we were in there talking about something pretty menial? But it doesn't mean it at the time it wasn't important. And you really just have to hear both sides of that story and help the two of them get to a point of understanding. Okay, see it from your point of view, see it from your point of view, and then let's find the compromise in the middle, or just have to go, you know what? I see both your points of view, but unfortunately for you, no, yes, for you, that's the way it's going to be. And then give them an opportunity of like, okay, if you really feel strongly, we can get that changed or get the layout of the building redesigned or whatever it is, but we can't do that right here, right now. We have to go with this particular outcome. So those moments are at the other end of that spectrum. The story you mentioned, I think before, there was a story at a Russian station once where a guy got stabbed, I believe, over revealing the ending of a book. And, you know, you can kind of see how that could happen down there, that if you've got very limited stimulation, and this was obviously probably the days pre-internet and pre-videos and Netflix. I mean, we could get Netflix to work down there in a slow buffering kind of way. But yeah, if you only had books and someone ruined the ending, you're like, I could see that. But thankfully in a year and a half, we never had anyone come to blows or anything like that, which, you know, in human nature, after that long as an isolated community, you'd almost go like, oh yeah, at some point that might happen. And certainly came close a couple of times, but cooler heads prevailed and saw some really, really good examples of mature behavior of people being able to back down and go, you know what? Not worth it. I'm going to walk away from this situation and you'll cool down later and they'll work it out. So.
Alcohol. We saw in the news recently there's going to be a ban on home brewing in Antarctica and a limit of 10 standard drinks per person per week. Yep. This is a bit of a shift, as I understand it, having spoken to some old expeditioners through research and social things. The craft beer brewing in Antarctica at the Australian stations in particular is something that people look on very fondly and have a lot of pride in.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your take? I mean, I also know like that alcohol is a problem in Antarctica and especially there's a book called Big Dead Place written by a guy about his experiences at in the American bases and the sort of rampant alcoholism that he and others engaged in as part of the experience. I guess when you're cold and you're in Antarctica, you know, fair enough. But yeah, what's the story with that? And I don't know, what would be your perspective on it?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you're right. The home brewing on the Australian stations, which I think we were some of the last stations or the stations that took it the most seriously, it had a huge community aspect to it. I loved brew nights. We'd do it probably once a fortnight or every now and then. And then for Oktoberfest, we all brewed our own. It was about half a dozen of us or so that then brewed our own beer. And one guy who, the guy who went on to win, did a great job. And he put it in the drying room annex, which was slightly warmer. And he was in there like boiling the hops. And we'd done all that stuff. And it's a shame that we'll lose that community side of it. But the decision behind that was really around that homebrew is unregulated. The alcohol control or content was, we're pretty good at it by the end, but, you know, it was anywhere between 4 and 6 odd percent. So you never really knew how strong the beer you were drinking was. And if you left it too long with too much sugar, of course, it starts to get out of hand. And then it didn't match the Australian government health advice. So what they've gone with now is a policy of you can take down an allocated amount that matches the guidance from the Department of Health or whoever about how alcohol consumption, and that's what you've got. And then the station leader will control access to special event alcohol, which was we had a pretty good selection for, which was event appropriate. So, you know, rum for gunfire breakfast on Anzac Day and champagne for New Year's, and then some like really good red wines and stuff for midwinter. So that'll all stay as far as I understand. And there was also a big drive towards industrial safety and everything down there as well. So it's really just realigning it to Australian standards, but the big loss is that community homebrew side of things, which it's just a sign of the times, unfortunately. But I was just glad I got to go down when it was still there and did enjoy. I reckon I probably enjoyed making it more than drinking the homebrew. Sometimes it was all right, but we always found it, if you had even like one or two homebrews after dinner, it seemed to cause sleep problems. We never really knew why, but I always felt you just never slept properly on the home. And there was rumors that, so our water down there, we run it at Davis, is desalinated seawater, and then it has to get remineralized before you consume it and everything. And then there was, you start to get, when you get really into the weeds of homebrew, you start to worry about your water and what's in it. And that was, you know, one of the theories there was that's why a homebrew causes sleep deprivation, because like if it's stripping your minerals out of you and blah, 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 blah. So anyway, all those topics will be null and void now when you've got, yeah, limited alcohol supply, and that's comes out of a registered brewery and they know what they're doing.
On that human side as well, I had a question around dating in Antarctica on the bases. Yeah. And I think this actually comes from a lot of people at the moment in lockdown in Sydney are starting to look at their housemates in a different way. And they're wondering whether it's worth it or whether it's a terrible idea. So what's your take on that? Is it when you're stuck with someone for a long period of time and you can't get away from them, do you date? Do you not date? Does dating look different in Antarctica?
That's a good question. Look, I reckon that probably sums it right up. If it's looking at your flatmate and going like, "Well, is it worth it?" Because if it's not and it doesn't go well, you've then got to live with them for the rest of however long you're locked down or you're living there or you're stuck in Antarctica. So we actually had a married couple in the wintering team, which was great. And they were really, half the time you couldn't even really tell they were married. They were really discreet about it. They had a shared room and stuff, but and they'd go on field trips as a duo. But other than that, they were pretty low key and. Not really a problem in terms of relationships on station throughout the winter. Summer was a bit more exciting. We had nearly 100 expeditioners and a much higher turnaround. So some expeditioners would come down for a couple of weeks and they'd fly in, fly out, and off they'd go to a different station. And there was a few expeditions that came down right at the end, just for a couple of weeks. And then some of the end of season parties and Australia Day and field trips and things, it all had a bit more of a interesting dynamic and social thing. But as the station leader, I was kind of removed from all of that. And I'd find out about things after the fact and always, be, oh, okay, didn't know that. Or I think a couple of times when I saw, because my office had some overflow accommodation, and then there was some interesting kind of people skirting past my office in the direction that, would indicate where they'd stayed the night that they were, and I knew exactly where everyone's rooms were. So I'm like, oh, I didn't know they were staying in that room. But anyway,
well, because of course the other great analog for living on a moon base is The Bachelor, which is currently on Australian TV. Get a bunch of people and stick them in a house together, and then watch to see what happens. So was it a bit like that in that sense? Like, were people more or less? How do I put this in a way that, no, the kids don't listen to this podcast. Were people more or less monogamously driven when they're in Antarctica?
The average age was in the low 30s.
Right.
Everyone was quite socially mature. I think if you had a younger crowd, it'd be a bit different, but it was quite benign. And look, that's just my year. Other years might be crazy. And there's all sorts of anecdotes and stories of other years where things really, really get interesting with different relationship dynamics and stuff on station. Ours was pretty calm. But I've been in lockdown, so that's my excuse. But I have been watching The Bachelor, and I reckon one point on that I feel like half the girls forget that it's not about the 20 girls in the house trying to be friends. You're all there to like win Jimmy and get time with Jimmy. So hating on the others for getting time with Jimmy, I'm like, that's the point. What you can't be like, oh, I can't believe she's talking to Jimmy again. You're like, yeah, that's the point of the show. Talk to Jimmy, win Jimmy. Anyway, so that, but look, it's a TV show. And
Yeah. Eyes on the prize, though. I agree. What do you think of Jimmy?
He seems all right. He's got a good amount of skills. So he's a pilot. He's got he knows boats. He can paddleboard and so I reckon,
he's got the motorbike. I was pretty impressed with his technical capability, I've got to say.
Yeah, I reckon I'd be mates with Jimmy. He seems like a good lad. I do like the skepticism and stereotypes around him being a pilot, though. I think that's probably a bit unfair to stereotype that all pilots, they're cheaters and all this sort of stuff. You're like, yeah, give him a go. I'm sure there's plenty of boring businessmen that are cheaters as well. So don't stereotype pilots just because he's a pilot.
Yeah, I think we're at the end of the season. We're trying to come up with something to keep the episodes rolling. And then we've got to hold out for the love story we've been promised, which is maybe pretty accurate as to human nature. To take us back to more like wholesome things, penguins.
Yep.
Yeah. Are you a fan, having lived among them? What do you reckon? Are they as cute as we think they are?
They are phenomenally cute. I love penguins. if at any point I was kind of grumpy or frustrated or anything like that, just watching penguins waddle around and fall over, they're as bad on land as we are at swimming. Like, they'd laugh at us because they are graceful and phenomenal in the water, but on land they're useless. And you look at them, and even now my background and stuff, looking at it, like, there's just, they always bring a smile to my face, and there's so many different types. And when we'd go out some days, you might be out driving around trying to count seals or change cameras at some of the time-lapse camera sites or anything like that. But if you ever saw like emperor penguin tracks, you'd then start to try, like, ooh, now you're kind of on the hunt for penguins. And and trying to find them. And we keep our distance when you do, but it's always fascinating to be like, ooh, well, there's been emperors around here, and trying to look out for them and then watch them. And they're huge, you know, they're nearly a meter tall, and they're quite loud, and they've got no land predators. So I find that's great. There's these safety distances of, oh, you can't approach penguins closer than this X amount or whatever. But if you sit still, they'll come to you, and you never have a problem trying to get them to kind of come and say hello, which is great. And yeah, love penguins.
That's awesome. Yeah, that was when I put out the call, most people wanted to know about the penguins. So yeah. I think that's pretty cool. And not all Antarctic bases have access to penguins as well. Like most of the ones on inland, they just lack penguins.
Correct. Yeah. So on the coast, there's penguins everywhere, all sorts of time. But even then, so our main intercontinental runway, which is near Casey Station, and well, I don't know off the top of my head. I said it's either 30 or 60 Ks inland, but considerable amount of distance inland. I think it might be closer to 60. They've had penguins there that have wandered that far up the Antarctic plateau and then just ended up at the Wilkins runway. Now, I don't think the fate of those penguins is going to be good, but they are a very curious little animal. And you could be, for us at Davis, you know, a number of Ks inland in the middle of rocks and nowhere near the ocean, and often not anywhere near a body of water, and you'd sort of see movement, or you're just walking along and you hear like, and you're like, oh, wow, there's
Could you make that there. Noise again for us? Fantastic. Yeah. No way of checking if that's accurate, but
oh,
that's
pretty
great.
Accurate. Yeah, well, you get pretty good at penguin noise. We had one guy on station who was really good at it, did it all the time.
Fantastic. We've got a question from a friend of mine who's going into space medicine. That's her area. And she's asked about what sort of medical procedures you tend to see on base, and also medications taken. And I understand you can't give details because that's sort of personal. But one thing I was just thinking about was I recently got a blood test, and my doctor was like, hey, you're highly deficient in vitamin D. And yeah. I was like, oh, no kidding. I've been inside for the last 18 months. Yep. So I've recently started taking vitamin D supplements for the first time in my life, which has been a very, you know, it's an interesting thing where you're like, oh, there you go. That's a thing that I didn't think that I would do. But yeah, I imagine vitamin D is something that is a thing that people tend to lack in Antarctica. But what else goes on medically?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, and funnily enough, I was talking to someone about this the other day, that actually the way your body produces vitamin D via sunlight is actually it metabolizes vitamin A or something. So sometimes you actually need to take vitamin A to produce vitamin D to increase levels. So certainly our vitamin D levels were tracked by the doctor in polar medicine along the way at times as well. And most of us, if not all, were on some level of vitamin D supplementation, and then you try and eat vitamin D rich foods or suggested foods and everything like that, or get some sunlight where you could. And then there was rumors that like, oh, actually your body can't photosynthesize the vitamin D if it's below zero, and you're like, well, what? And then there's no ozone layer down there, so you go outside to try and get some vitamin D and you get burnt within 2 minutes. So that was, you know, yeah, that's probably one of the common ones. And there's all these little polar, they call it polar hands, and then you have a lot of nasal problems as well with the really dry air down there. So your skin dries out phenomenally. I myself had problems with that, and as did a number of other expeditioners. You find your nostrils and your skin and your hands and your legs and all sorts of things have skin problems. So then I switched to the kind of the Wim Hof cold shower model, and you try and do that to help deal with your dry skin, and maybe that helped, maybe it didn't. So you have a lot of those weird self experiments to try and deal with your common problems. Otherwise, the main issues, main injuries on station are probably just akin to what would happen in daily life over a year or so. You know, a couple of stitches from like bumped heads and different cuts and abrasions on different hands and those sorts of things. Thankfully, over the year and a half, didn't have any broken bones or anything like that. And the doctor did a great job, and he's very multi-skilled and had a great background in kind of bush medicine. So he had all sorts of stories, and I'm sure would have been able to handle anything that we had. I mean, the great story is that another Russian story of a guy having to take his own appendix out. So
yeah,
I get that question a bit. So only the doctor has their appendix removed in the Australian program these days. The rest of us Go down there with an appendix if you've still got one, and if it's got, if it has problems, the doctor will, you know, deal with it. So he's very clear with, he's like, if you have any sort of abdominal pain or upset stomach or anything like that that you think could be heading that way, go and see him. Don't try and deal with it for a few days and then go, oh, I've had this pain in the stomach for a week. Yeah. So
What sort of testing do you have access to down there in terms of, like, if you get bloods done or something, can you run them on base?
I don't think he could do, I think with the vitamin D tests, we did them at the end of summer and they send them back to be tested, but I'm certainly not a doctor. Did have a pretty good medical facility down there, so probably can do some pathology and everything, but maybe not to the same level that you get back in Australia. And then they've got some really good telehealth facilities and everything down there as well, so that in the event you've got to do brain surgery, you know, obviously there's not a brain surgeon, but we've got a general surgeon on station and then he can chat to a brain surgeon remotely via video link and potentially put your brain back together and, you know, fix you up.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. One of my friends has actually just gone up to Tennant Creek as a doctor, and she met another doctor at Tennant Creek who's going to be heading to Antarctica in the next season as one of the station's doctors. So maybe that's what they go for, that experience working in a place that is pretty remote, sees a lot of pretty intense stuff, and you know, you don't have a whole lot of fancy hospital options open to you, so you have to develop that experience. And I guess it would be hard to develop that experience anywhere else, but that would be interesting hearing that your doctor also had that kind of background. I wonder, if you're listening, maybe consider doing that.
And I think the doctor on station has a really tough role as well, because, you know, as the station leader, you know, it's a weird leadership dynamic to live and work with your team. But essentially for me as the station leader, if people didn't like me or didn't really want to talk to me, it actually wasn't, you know, at times it's not great as a leader to have that. But you go, well, it's not actually the end of the world if they don't like me, like, bugger it. As long as they listen to me and do what they're told, like, we'll get on with it. But for the doctor, he's got to live and work, or she has to live and work with the team, but also keep access and everything as well. So I think that's another challenge that's rare. It does happen in small rural communities for doctors, but it's more apparent on an Antarctic station of, like, oh, he had to walk a pretty fine line between patient and friends and all that stuff. And then, of course, he you could go in and see him and talk about any range of medical issues, which I'm sure we had, and then he's got to go and, you know, have lunch next to you afterwards. So yeah, you've got that strange, and that's, you know, that goes for every job and every person on station as well, but more so I think for the doctor and the station leader have that strange situation.
Final question for you, and then we've got to get to the 11 a.m. press conference, which has become the guiding light of my day. Ooh. David, what's next for you? If you got a call from someone, you know, maybe someone listening to the podcast who has such powers, who said, hey, do you want to lead a base on the moon down the track? Or you know, if you got any sort of call, what's next for you? What are you looking to do? Would you want to go to space?
I would love to go to space. I'm too tall. I think I'm 6'3", so that probably counts me out of most of the current space programs. But I would absolutely love to work with a team or anyone that was looking at long-term space exploration and how to run a moon base or a station or any of those sorts of strange social experiments. And I have some good thoughts and background. And like I said, I'd love to just sit in a room with a bunch of psychologists who are studying those things, and there'd be some fascinating insights for that. Otherwise, I'm really taking some time to get my life back on track here in Melbourne. We're renovating my house and doing a bit of public speaking, and then looking at professional opportunities in the future to move either into the consulting side of things with leadership and management training and coaching, or back to government work, or, you know, future Antarctic work, and maybe go to Antarctic tourism or anything. So I'm kind of open to a lot of things. If anyone out there is interested in my resume, just give us a buzz. And
Look, maybe Osher Gunsberg is going to give you a call.
Yeah, my sister is onto, she's going to listen to this. She is onto me about being the bachelor. I'm very, very, very set on not doing that.
All right. Well, if you're listening and you've got some ideas, or you can hook David up with the Bachelor casting team, do get in contact. But also, I know there's a few people looking at doing some analogs to do with, yeah, chucking people in weird locations and then watching to see what happens. So that might also be of interest. We've heard it here. David is keen to be studied. So I'm sure that you'll get lots of opportunities. But this has been such a delight. Thank you so much for making time to chat. And I hope that your day 13 test comes back the way you want it to come back, and that you can continue to go about your life back in warmer climates.
Hopefully. No, thanks very much for having me on, and yeah, all the best for the lockdown up there in Sydney, and for your listeners who are getting through the lockdown. Just imagine what it's going to be like looking back is one of the best ways to get through a lockdown or a challenge like that.
Brilliant. Thank you.
You've been listening to Space Junk. You can find David's cute photos of penguins on Instagram at @button_film. And as always, you can follow me on Annie Handmer on all the socials.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.